So I've been reporting on Israel and Palestine like for a really long time. A lot of my early journalistic career was pretty much like in that space, almost not exclusively, but predominantly. The U.S. population in particular is like primed to have that be probably one of the most polarizing issues, period, you know, and it's very much along the existing like left-right divide, but not necessarily, you know, but it's a lot of it is also like baked into the religious landscape of the United States, you know, through Christian Zionism and a lot of other stuff. And I don't know. I've done a lot on the history of Zionism and a lot about some of the messianic movements, both like in Israel and in the U.S. that see a lot of what's happening now, oddly enough, as necessary for the fulfillment of end times prophecy. And some of those groups have like a very direct and openly stated posture that they should do absolutely everything at the, that they possibly can to hasten the coming of the end times. So that's definitely, you know, I guess maybe some people view that as conspiratorial thinking and looking at this current conflict. But I mean, if you think about it and you have these like world leaders, both in Israel and the US and elsewhere, thinking that certain things need to happen for religious motivations that they care deeply about, those are probably going to shape geopolitical events, specifically in this area, to a very significant degree. And it's been going on for many years, if not really centuries. And I don't know. I mean, I can get more in the weeds about that if you want, because I think, honestly, one of the big issues as it comes to people understanding this particular conflict is that not a lot of people have really dug that deeply into the history of Zionism at all. And like a lot of people I talked to in the States, like when I lived there, didn't even realize that Israel's creation as a state happened as recently as 1948. Like there's people that think it's always been there and don't really get the conflict at all, you know? So I think, you know, that really makes it easy to, you know, for certain quote unquote influencers in different spaces to shape narratives that aren't necessarily accurate. But, you know, if you dig deeper into the history of Zionism and also into some of these more like messianic focused movements that are very intertwined with the political landscape of both the US and Israel, that's probably like the best way to predict how this is going to play out over the next couple months and years. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. With the biblical tilt, you have the Christians like Mike Pence here in the US who want that temple to be brought down and then rebuilt, which will symbolize.
Oh, it's not just Pence though. It's the Christian Zionists are very big on the destruction of the Dome of the Rock or the Al-Aqsa Mosque for the purpose of the rebuilding of the Third Temple, which is also huge with a lot of, I guess, segments of Israeli society that are in power right now with the current Netanyahu-led coalition, some of these more like extremist settler groups, very into the destruction of that existing structure. And this is all about like end time stuff, but it's also not just them. Like if you're a subscriber to the influence of secret societies, for example, you know, Freemasons, totally obsessed with the Third Temple also. So there's like all these different groups of varying influence that are very interested in seeing something happen there and see it as a prerequisite to their differing, you know, but overlapping, you know, end time theories coming to fruition. So for people that don't know, Al-Aqsa Mosque is, I believe, it's the third holiest site in Islam. So if anything happens to that building, you're going to have the entire Muslim world coming after the people who were responsible. Yeah. And some of the current people in Israel's government or factions that are now quite heavily represented in their legislature and in the current administration were people that like back in the 1980s were trying to tunnel under the Dome of the Rock to blow it up. And were considered, you know, very fringe extremists at that time, but now they're not. Like now they're in power. And there's a very, you know, there's a lot of risk there for sure, of having something happen to that building. And it'll probably be, you know, I don't really look forward to that happening, but it seems almost inevitable just because so many people think it has to happen for their different, you know, eschatological, you know, beliefs to come out. And I don't know. I mean, it's just so crazy to talk about because this is like such a level of, I guess, reality that a lot of people don't think about. That, like, you know, people think, oh, this is confirmation of, you know, what I was taught as a kid in church or whatever. Like, I think that's how they want people to feel, because these people have also very openly stated they're intentionally doing it because they don't want to wait for God to do it. They have to do it. Like, that's the theological justification, both on the Christian and Jewish side, to make this happen. I mean, all very... very nuts. So it's basically like a self-fulfilling prophecy in a sense, but it's going to lead to a lot of death and destruction and complete madness. And, you know, I mean, the deeper you go into like this whole like messianic stuff, like the Jewish Messiah and the Mashiach and all that stuff, and what that's supposed to mean in both the Christian and Jewish sense, and this idea of like, you know, New World Order sort of springing from that. Yeah, I mean, it gets pretty nuts when you consider the possibilities of where this could, go if these people in the driver's seat trying to, you know, have a particular vision they're trying to fulfill, how successful will they be in fulfilling that vision? I don't know. It's worth, doing some research into what they believe and what they think needs to happen. So one of the things, you know, they think needs to happen is the complete expulsion of all Palestine, of all Palestinians from the state of Israel, you know, from the occupied territories in Gaza, and also, you know, Israel, you know, itself, where there's like, you know, Palestinian citizens that are Israeli citizens, but they're, of, you know, they're Palestinian. So basically the idea that they all need to be ethnically cleansed, essentially. From the area. And this is like really prominent in Christian Zionism. And, you know, like you mentioned, Mike Pence, there's a lot of other really powerful people that subscribe to that. And it's very prominent, particularly in the Republican Party. But I mean, one of the main organizations directing a lot of this within the United States is called KUFI, Christians United for Israel. And Netanyahu has described KUFI as essential to Israel's national security. And there's a lot of overlap between the two. So definitely worth exploring that stuff. And I actually did a really in-depth piece about all of this stuff that's well-sourced and probably one of the best articles I've written on the subject, called The Untold History of Christian Zionism. You can find it on Mint Press News, where I used to write. It was part of a longer series, but I stopped because the Epstein thing happened and my whole career kind of changed after that. But managed to get this out before all that happened. Definitely worth taking the time to look at it, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Because this is going to be a really crazy series of events in the Middle East, for sure.
It's very scary. The vitriol is at an all-time high. You have both sides calling for genocide in that part of the world. And it's baffling. I've seen you been tweeting about it, and I've just been observing. Again, I've been trying to be very intentional, not have any hot takes on the subject, because if I'm being completely honest, fog of war, things are going on in real time, and I honestly don't know what's happening, what intentions are, or what any ulterior motives may be. But the one observation I have made is that it's just stunning that everybody's been riled up so successfully, and this is coming off the heels of the COVID lockdowns, the vaccine mandates, the war in Ukraine. And it's like, if you're a puppet master, if you were to envision a puppet master, it's like you get the COVID lockdowns, you get everybody scared, you get the war in Ukraine, you get everybody on the left supporting that, and then you get this war where you get the neocons supporting what's going on in Israel and Palestine right now.
Of course.
And everybody gets what they want.
Well, the whole thing about neoconservatives, like from their origins, from a political standpoint, have consistently been about basically unifying American foreign policy and Israeli foreign policy, like tooling U.S. foreign policy to benefit Israeli foreign policy. So hence the war in Iraq and a lot of other stuff. And this goes back to like policy documents written by very important figures in that movement, like Richard Pearl, his A Clean Break in the late 90s, calling for the removal of Saddam Hussein. And I mean, even people like Hillary Clinton, who people don't think of as necessarily a neoconservative, but sort of very much fulfilling of that pro-war line, also in, you know, leaked emails talked about starting fomenting the quote unquote Syrian revolution and all of the, you know, the proxy war stuff that happened there as a way to benefit Israel explicitly and stuff like that. And it's, you know, there's differing opinions, of course, as to why that is, if whether it's over due to undue influence of Israel over the United States or the U.S. seeing Israel as a useful tool to keep the Middle East perpetually unstable. And of course, Britain also being in that mix, seeing that as favorable as well. But again, you know, this is all really complicated stuff. And I think what you mentioned earlier about this coming on the heels of COVID and people being really riled up. So every time people get really riled up over something, the people that are trying to hurt us into insane digital enslavement land use that to their benefit, right? And it essentially becomes another you know, opportunity to deploy divide and conquer tactics, of course, for their benefit and not for ours. So there was a take that I thought was kind of interesting. And obviously, I'm going to paraphrase here. And I think it was Gareth Eich that said it. But something like, you know, in any situation, well, not necessarily any situation, but I guess this situation, you know, people are really being pushed to pick a side. You know, are you with Hamas or are you with the IDF? But what we should really do is pick the side of all the, you know, the innocent civilians who aren't part of these freaking banker wars. And we should just step off the chessboard and stop playing their game. And I think that's, you know, a pretty good take, honestly, because, you know, obviously, I mean, I haven't been following what's happened here super closely, but as far as I understand it, you know, the first bloodshed was this rave in southern Israel. And apparently that was for the purpose of, you know, promoting like peace with the Palestinians. So like a lot of the people that were killed there were Israelis that, for example, had chosen not to serve in the IDF and things like that. You know, people that Palestinians, I think, would normally see as allies within Israel. But then you have people's, you know, sort of glorifying that on one side. And then, of course, on the other side, Gaza, half of the population of Gaza are children, you know, under the age of 18. And so promoting the carpet bombing of that, the refusal to let humanitarian aid in, bombing people who are evacuating per IDF instructions and all of this stuff. I mean, there's no celebrating that. And there's this whole return of this mentality of you're either with us or you're with the terrorist stuff. You know, just like, you know, the post 9/11 mentality, which is the same mentality a lot of these same people were criticizing from the left during the COVID era. You know, it's come back, and I think unfortunately shows that a lot of people are still very much caught in that trap and pretty easily manipulated, you know, by the powers that be. And it's not, again, you know, benefiting any of the regular people here, whether it's in Israel, Palestine, or somewhere else. You know, there's just a lot of, you know, innocent people that don't want any of this. And I would also encourage people to keep in mind that Israel and also, you know, Hamas and the Gaza Strip, like, forced the COVID vaccine on the populations that they rule over. So, you know, that's also something to keep in mind. And there's a lot of documentation that's come out, you know, over the years preceding this current conflict of how Israel wanted Hamas to be in control of the Gaza Strip, because they could treat it as a hostile entity and not have to, you know, deal with the peace process, which, you know, if you're familiar with a lot of, you know, at least the national level is really, you know, how politics works there. There's been a consistent effort to sabotage any sort of two-state solution for a really long time. And of course, you know, the fact that those forces in Israel would want Hamas to be in power in the Gaza Strip suggests that Hamas is not the group that is going to act in the best interests of Palestinians or Palestinian sovereignty, right? So I don't know. Those are just some things I'd like to say, I guess, about the conflict. But again, you know, the loss of human life is always going to be lamentable there. But I have a feeling that the pot is only going to continually be stirred because, you know, a lot of these same groups that, you know, I brought up earlier that have this whole messianic flavor to everything. They do think that we, you know, there needs to be a big war between Israel and Iran for the end times, and that the Dome of the Rock's got to get blown up and all the Palestinians have to be removed from Israel and all these different things have to happen. And you have people with major influence over major governments in this whole conflict, whether directly involved right now or in the periphery or soon to be involved, you know, who feel that way. Crazy. Yeah.
No, it's completely insane. It's extremely disheartening. Again, to see the vitriol and just the animalistic reaction to this, where it's like us versus them. And like you mentioned, half the population of Gaza, 1.1 million of the 2.2, are under the age of 18. And a lot of people have been like, oh, they're all pro Hamas. They voted them in. But it's like half the population is not a voting age. So that doesn't really make sense. Then you have the whole like attack on this rave and then getting through the borders, which was really perplexing considering how tightly secured those borders have been historically.
Most definitely.
Yeah.
And the comparisons from Israel's government saying that this was Israel's 9/11. And very odd when you like are aware of the extensiveness of Israel's, you know, surveillance capabilities domestically as well as internationally. I mean, it's just absurd that they wouldn't have been able to know that was going to happen in advance. And there's people that are like, you know, IDF veterans and Israelis that definitely are no friends of, you know, Palestine or Hamas that are saying that's the case. And, you know, if you're familiar with the realities of 9/11, there's only really a few possibilities there. Either it was intentionally done by, you know, intelligence agencies, or it was allowed to happen by intelligence agencies. So I think we can assume that, you know, similar possibilities may have happened here with Israel, because, you know, before all of this happened, Netanyahu was facing like major issues domestically, a huge amount of protests against him, major efforts to remove him from power. He's been trying to stay in power because the justice system, this particular attorney, has been going after him for corruption for some time. And so he teamed up with sort of these far, sort of like extremist groups, I guess, that we touched on earlier as sort of a way, like, I'll help you guys get into power if you help me pass this judicial reform legislation that will, if it does pass, essentially allow Netanyahu to get off the hook for the charges he's facing. And so that conveniently all goes away. And now there's a new unity government that's justified by the war. And tellingly, the, you know, polls from within Israel, most Israelis for everything going on right now blame Netanyahu and want him to resign.
Yeah, so it's very convenient. And again, it's the hearkening to 9/11 is mind-blowing. Like, on just pattern recognition, I was 10, 11 when 9/11 happened and witnessed everything that happened. Got, as a fourth grader, got pulled into the war drum beating. Like, they riled us up at our elementary school. Like, we got to go to war. We got to go to war. And it was on my computer because I wanted to pull up this tweet. Here's the original tweet. Nobody said on 9/11, America must retaliate proportionally. Both sides need to show restraint. Where's the proof of all the dead bodies? You are oversimplifying. There's context about the conflict you're ignoring. Let's try to de-escalate the situation. And so this is somebody from the Israel side saying, like, no, like, we didn't question this during 9/11. Like, we shouldn't have to question it now. Then Tom Woods, quote tweet that said, if only we had spoken and thought like this instead of pointlessly blowing trillions of dollars and killing at least 4.5 million people. According to the Washington Post, what we laughingly call the conservative movement is a disgrace. So it's just like, it feels like what happened after 9/11 is happening again. And knowing the aftermath of 9/11 and how fucked up it was, we lied to get into the war as weapons of mass destruction. didn't exist. Like, nobody ever questions the Saudi involvement, like, who was actually driving the planes, flying the planes, and the Patriot Act that came after it and led to the dystopian hellscape that we're currently living in. And it's just mind-boggling that people can't see the pattern recognition. Like, it's the same playbook over again, in my mind. Obviously, fog of war, things are happening, people are dying by the hundreds day in and day out, and people are really riled up and unable to see clearly what's going on. But sitting at my desk here in Austin, Texas, and observing this from afar, it seems pretty obvious that the playbook is being run back.
Yeah, and you know what's actually pretty disturbing to me? I've talked about this with a couple people that I've worked with in the past, like Robbie Martin and Jeremy Lafredo. I've had some concerns for a while that some of the people that became prominent as sort of dissidents in the COVID-19 era became very cozy or were directly tied to the neoconservatives who came to prominence during the Bush era. And were sort of, in my opinion, trying to bring a lot of, you know, so think about the MAGA base, right? And how sort of Trump became popular. Well, Trump, when he was campaigning in 2015, was very much like took an anti-neocon posture, right? Mm-hmm. And not necessarily anti-war, but definitely, you know, less Iraq was a mistake, for example, in saying things of that nature. And that was very popular. And really among, you know, the Republican voting base, there was a mass rejection of neocon foreign policy. And that seems to have changed, isn't it? And it seems like there's been a lot of figures that have sort of regained the trust of that particular base during the COVID era and are now currently saying we need to go to war and bomb the crap out of Gaza and maybe Iran and maybe Lebanon.
The whole Iran thing.
Something to think about.
Like the Lindsey Grahams of the world and Nikki Haley's coming out and being like, we need to go attack Iran. It's like, whoa. Like they're.
I don't know how people still vote for Lindsey Graham. That guy is insane. He goes on TV and says the most like insane like war. I don't know. I don't know how people believe that and like look at that guy and are like, that's who I want to vote for. Unless they're like, you know, they work for defense contractors or they just have like mush brain. You know, I just don't get it.
No. Yeah, he's 70 years old, no children, just wants to bomb the crap out of the world. Then die and just leave us with the mess.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Yikes. Yeah, but anyway, there's some websites. So some of these neocon guys like Frank Gaffney, people that were tied up with PNAC, if you're familiar, Project for a New American Century, and its, I guess, follow-up organization, the Foreign Policy Initiative. A lot of those people got involved with the Stop Vaccine Passport stuff. And even made a website, I think it was called like stopvaccinepassports.com or something, and got very like involved with those efforts with COVID. And there's a lot of them ended up popping up, like Frank Gaffney in particular, on Steve Bannon's pandemic war room stuff, right? And sort of rehabilitating some neocon foreign policy, but being like, oh, we're against globalism and digital IDs and the vaccine passport, you know, saying all this stuff that sort of brings that base back. And then when the time is right and the trust is there, they're like, and war with Iran, which is exactly where the Bush era neocons were going, like after Iraq anyway.
Yeah. I mean, before,
I don't know.
Before he died.
This seems overly convenient to me.
Yeah.
So again, this is why I like to tell people, don't have political saviors and please think for yourself, because if you just, you know, outsource your brain, okay, you're not outsourcing your brain to MSM anymore, but you're outsourcing your brain to Ben Shapiro and Jordan Peterson and, you know, Steve Bannon and people like that. You're not necessarily going to get led in a better direction than MSM would eventually lead you.
Yeah, you got to think for yourself.
Not at this point.
And you have to slay your heroes if they start leading you astray. And it's very obvious that it's happening right now. And again, going back to the convenience of the timing of it all, whether it's the sort of political morass that Netanyahu found himself in a few months ago or here in the U.S., we have a financial crisis that's on the verge of popping off. I'm not sure if you've been paying attention to what's going on there, but it's pretty obvious.
Yeah, that something sure. is structurally but war broken. Helps, right? Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So it's all very convenient. Mm-hmm. Just similar to COVID in 2019, the fall of 2019, it was becoming right. glaringly obvious that the financial system was systemically fragile. And it's becoming glaringly obvious that we're back at that point again in the fall of 2023. And like you said, war
right.
Helps.
Well, war traditionally lets the Fed print lots and lots of money because it's war. We got to do it. We got to win the war. Right. So I think we can guess what'll happen there. Yeah. Unfortunately,
yeah.
not going to get much better. But I do want to sort of circle back bring up, I guess, some research I've done in the past and was sort of the subject of what I talked about at the Bitcoin conference in May. So there's like this particular group. It's a public-private partnership. It's housed within the World Economic Forum, the WEF. But the main, groups that compose this partnership are the FBI and the DOJ and the Secret Service, Israel's one of their security agencies, and the UK National Crime Agency, and then a bunch of banks, right? And then a few tech companies here and there. I think Palantir, maybe it's PayPal, Microsoft. I mean, some of these big guys are there. And basically, they're led by a former Israeli spy named Tal Goldstein that used to develop a lot of really crazy policies for Netanyahu. And Jeremy Jurgens, who I guess is number two at the WEF after Klaus Schwab at the big WEF meeting earlier this year, was like, yep, big giant cyber attack before 2025. And, you know, the part of the WEF PAC, the Partnership Against Cybercrime, that's the DOJ and all of these guys, say that it's going to be a cyber attack on the banks. Isn't that convenient that, like, the banks can just be like, oh, well, we've collapsed, but it wasn't our fault. It was the fault of these nasty hackers. And I'm sure the hackers will be Hamas and Iran, you know. They can blame anyone. Because as we know from Vault 7 and WikiLeaks, right, the CIA has the ability to frame literally any government it wants or any group it wants for a cyber attack. And the CIA lost control of those tools, hence WikiLeaks obtaining them and publishing them. And, you know, anyone can do it. Anyone can blame anyone. So it's very difficult to attribute. And even if you look at headlines about cyber attacks that have happened over the past several years, it's usually a cybersecurity company that, if you look on its website, was created by NQTEL, the CIA, or it was created by Israel's Unit 8200, which is Israel's like NSA equivalent. And they're saying stuff like high probability that it might have been these guys. And our proof is that we don't have any proof, but it looks like something they might have done before. We think they did before. I mean, it's just like there's no evidence for anything. But out of, you know, that gobbledygook, you get a headline that says Chinese hackers responsible, you know, or, you know, Iranian hackers responsible. And that's all people see and read, right?
Yeah. And it's very easy to see that we could be in chapter one of the systemic bank failure, where it starts with this conflict in the Middle East. It keeps rising.
Yeah.
And then there's an excuse to begin cyber attacking perceived enemies. And that's how the banks get attacked.
So there's this whole group of the big banks that's very secretive, and it's affiliated with WEFPAC, and they have been gaming this out since like 2021 or so. It's a FSISAC, the Financial Services Information Sharing and Analysis Center.
Yeah,
and they collaborated with the European Central Bank, the Fed, the Carnegie Endowment, that at the time was run by the current CIA director, William Burns. Talking about exactly how this was going to play out, the cyber attack on the banks.
Yeah. And I know I sent you this information probably a couple months at this point, But in parallel to all this going on, the Bank of International Settlements has been running CBDC trials with partner central banks around the world. So maybe they're doing that in parallel. A cyber attack's happened, and it's like, oh, thank God we've been running this.
But I think they're going to do it a couple different ways to try and keep populations from rebelling against it in certain countries where there's a growing awareness about CBDCs. So I think it's pretty clear that direct issue CBDCs, like as the BIS has laid out, are going to or have already happened in basically BRICS countries. So Brazil, Russia, China, it's all pretty much set up to play out that way, just as the BIS has foretold. But I think in some of these countries where the population is more wary of CBDCs or obvious centralized control of CBDCs, they're going to try and keep the two-tier system, you know, as it exists like right now in the US, and basically have the CBDC exist, but the public doesn't necessarily interact with it, which is, you know, essentially what FedNow is going to be, right? It's about settlements like between banks, and they'll use the CBDC, and then they'll the public will interact instead with deposit tokens. And that'll be issued by the commercial banks, and that's what the public will interact with. And they're not called CBDCs, but they're programmable money, and they're going to run on the rails of FedNow. And it's really not that different of a system, but they can, you know, oh, I have my JP Morgan deposit tokens, and I have my Citibank deposit tokens, and I have my Wells Fargo deposit tokens, and it's not a CBDC, right?
It's an abstracted white label CBDC, if you will.
Yeah. Well, if you look at the big banks in the US, they're all in deposit tokens and tokenized assets. JP Morgan, all in. And they're, you know, the banks that, who are the banks that run the Fed? Right. So, I mean, the most powerful Fed bank is the one in New York, right? And the main, you know, shareholders of that bank, it's Citi and JP Morgan. And the head of JP Morgan, of course, is Jamie Dimon. And the person who essentially created Citibank, Jamie Dimon. So it's basically the same crowd that decides what goes on there. And I mean, if you've been looking at what Jamie Dimon has been saying recently, you know, about stuff like we should seize private property for the purpose of combating climate change. You want these banks to be able to issue you programmable money. Like, it doesn't have to be a CBDC issued by the Fed to like have the same consequences. You know what I mean?
No, I mean, you could argue the way the financial system set up now, like it practically already exists. Like, they can just unperson anybody.
Yeah.
And
totally,
for any reason.
They have.
Yeah.
It happened to what? Merkel? And in his banks, they got deplatformed from Chase without any warning.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we had Russell Brand, didn't get debanked, but got kicked off of YouTube. We had Nigel Farage in the UK, had his bank accounts ripped out from under him. It's totally possible right now. It's just not as popular, I guess. A CBDC-like system would make it easier, but I think it's totally possible today. It's just not politically palatable for most people.
Right. Well, I mean, I think in the US, again, it's they're going to try and set it up a different way than they're like running it in China and Russia and some of these BRICS countries, which are much more, you know, the multipolar world order, you know, that crowd or whatever, are a lot of them seem to be favoring the direct issue CBDC. But, you know, you've already had like, you know, some statements from the Fed about like a wariness toward a CBDC that some people have sort of taken as proof for some mystical, like, trust the Fed QAnon equivalent thing that Jerome Powell and Jamie Dimon are like actually our friends. And like, no, I think that just means that they know that a lot of people in the US would resist a CBDC direct issued, you know, a push for that system. And so they're going to create essentially the same system in a way that seems a little more palatable, or at least not as obvious, or at least more analogous to the current system. Right.
Yeah. There's a theory out there. It's being popularized by Tom Luongo, who I like, I've had on this show, but he's convinced that the Fed via their interest rate policy and being directed by the big banks here in the U.S. is essentially attacking the Davos class by trying to collapse the European banking system, by draining the euro dollar system with this high interest rate regime.
Yeah, I'm familiar, and he apparently doesn't like what I have to say about this, I've been told. But rule number one for me is never trust the bankers and never trust the Fed, and I'm going to stick by that.
That's a good rule.
Because it's worked really well for me so far. So, you know, I don't think Jamie Dimon and Jerome Powell play 3D and 5D chess. I don't. I think, you know, essentially the world as it is now, I think it's a lot more run by transnational capital than a lot of people would like to think, you know? And I think that's why you end up seeing commonalities, for example, with COVID. You know, why did the U.S. go all in for a lot of the same COVID policies and draconian, you know, lockdowns and restrictions of civil liberties that happened in Russia and China and the entire world? Obviously, there's a lot more that the elite agree on than they disagree on when it comes to, you know, keeping their respective populations under the boot, right?
Yeah.
And why did they all seem to get together at these globalist groups like Davos and what have you, you know?
Jackson Hole, Bilderberg. But yeah, no, it's right. It's, it seems like if the end goal is to confuse and instill fear in the global population to cattle herd them into this system, like it's it's happening in real time. So you can believe that the Fed and the commercial banks here in the U.S. are attacking Europe and use that as like a diversion tactic to be like, no, they're on our side, and just get everybody placated and sort of believing that that's the truth. And then at the end of the day, they are all just like, ha ha, we played you.
Trust the plan is now trust the Fed. I'm not a believer. Sorry. Yeah, but I do want to point out that, you know, we are really in unprecedented times, and there's obviously going to be a lot of big shifts, and they're probably going to happen in the next 1 to 2 years. So that cyber attack we were talking about earlier, once that happens, they're going to push for, and they've already mapped it out, the end of both online and financial anonymity. So if you're, you know, talking about CBDCs or any sort of CBDC equivalent system, you know, essentially, you know, KYC, right? That's all going to be forced on everybody for everything. And anything that doesn't have that or affords any sort of financial privacy or anonymity will be made illegal under national security justifications. So we can expect a Cyber Patriot Act to come after this event. Yeah, that's going to have that stuff in it because they've already mapped out the policy. And then, of course, the end of online anonymity means tying a government-issued ID to your internet access and having internet access, you know, require that at the ISP level. And that's what they've mapped out to do.
It's extremely terrifying.
The internet as you know it now will not exist after this happens, right? And you'll, you know, what they'll say is, oh, you want to be allowed to be back online? You know, you have to get this ID, which of course is going to be some sort of digital ID equivalent, you know, since they're pushing for all of this with the CBDCs at the same time, right? But the goal is no anonymity period, and to have everything you do surveilled and compiled and, you know, have AI oversee it all and do all this predictive policing, pre-crime stuff based on what you've already done and what you will do. So essentially the most important thing to do is not to participate in the system after that event. Just don't do it. So I would say if you want some of the stuff that's like on the internet now in terms of like knowledge, back that up offline, download it, put it on hard drives, Faraday bag it, keep it, you know, safe. Because if you might want that stuff after all this happens and you don't want to have to, you know, get the cattle tag to be able to be online, you know, you definitely think ahead, because if you want to believe what the WEF says about this timeline on this stuff, which is, I would take them seriously, you know, you've got like a year, give or take a few months, before the internet gets, you know, nuked, basically.
Completely cucked. Now that you mentioned that, like the timeline of everything, like going all the way back to COVID, Ukraine, Russia, And then this time last year, you had the emergence of what many people would describe as the first consumer-ready AI applications. Then you have this pop off in the Middle East, the banking crisis happening in parallel. Like, everything is just lining up almost too perfectly.
Yeah, there's a lot lining up, and it's not good. But the good thing is that, you know, the more you look at the stuff, the more you can think about solutions, right? So definitely want to talk about that in a second. I'm going to drink some water really quick so I don't cough everywhere. Sorry. Been kind of sick for a week or two. Yeah, so a lot of crazy stuff going on right now is happening thanks to, or at least it's being enabled by in a huge way by big tech. So I'll give some examples before we talk about like AI in general, because I'm writing a piece on that I think is pretty important. But Microsoft, you know, over the last 3 months, I forget exactly when, because I've sort of been in an offline bubble a lot of the time with my son. But they essentially came out and said, like, all right, you use a Microsoft, you know, Windows machine. Your data is not your data anymore. And we're going to take your data whenever we want off the machine and train our AI on it. And you can't opt out. And if we decide to, we can just delete your data or block you from accessing your device by blocking your Microsoft ID or whatever. So if you're using a Windows machine, your data is not your data. And if you're serious about fighting this stuff, you have no excuse to not invest in some sort of freedom tech stuff. So I definitely think people, particularly like in the Bitcoin space, need to put a lot more attention, considering what we're facing, on freedom tech and supporting developers that are developing that tech.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you're aware of the project, but Start OS is basically a Linux-based system that's trying to create a new operating system external to Microsoft and Apple that people can use and use open source software products to run their lives. So use something like Nextcloud instead of Dropbox, and have Jitsi instead of Zoom.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, I think even Jitsi like got rid of their anonymity function recently too. Like,
really?
A lot of these are under attack. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, there's a huge need to divest from big tech as much as possible. And it needs to happen quickly, because unless you know, the choice is either participate in the system being designed for you by the crazy people and become a slave, or don't become a slave, right? So if you don't want to be a slave, you have to invest now in making in big tech alternatives, unless you want to live a completely analog life, right?
Yeah.
And so if you don't think it's practical for you to live an analog life, you got to find something that works that isn't these guys.
No, and it's not easy. It's hard, like running Start OS, getting a private public key pair set up on Noster and interacting with those different clients is definitely harder. It's more rough around the edges, but it's getting better. And if you shift the development talent, particularly to focus on these areas, I think you can reach parity with big tech in terms of being able to do on your computer and interact on social networks
You
do in the incumbent system.
Well, here's the thing. People are lazy and like don't want to have to learn how to do something new or something that like maybe has two steps more than what they used before. I mean, people have to get over that. You know, it's not going to be the easiest route is to go the slavery route. And that's how they've designed it on purpose. The whole selling point of that system is that it's convenient and easy. So obviously it's going to take some work to go the other route. But yeah, I mean, the future of human freedom depends on it. So I think it's a pretty easy choice. And if you have to do some, you know, tutorials or whatever, why the internet is still like sort of functioning the way it should function to an extent in terms of like democratizing access to information, like, let's please do that and not be like, oh man, I wish I did that now that they've you know, screwed the whole internet over and I have to get a digital ID if I want to be online anymore, you know?
Yeah.
Like, now is the time. Now is the time. And not enough people are talking about it or are focused on solutions. And I think, you know, that's one of the major problems in independent media right now, just in general, is that it's all about clicks and who's going to watch my stuff and talking about stuff that's going to keep my audience like sucked in, I guess. And not necessarily so much about like, how do we get out of this? And if you want to think that this timeline or, you know, if it seems to you like it does to me, that the timeline for action is getting increasingly small, we got to start doing stuff and we got to start talking about how to do that stuff. And if you don't have like the developing, you know, the programming know-how or whatever, there are people that do, right? And you can support them or you can learn.
Yeah.
And divest somehow. I mean, for people that don't want to do that too, you know, there's options like Ramiro Romani runs a Above phone and they make de-Googled smartphones ready to go. Super easy. You can buy it from his website. They're making laptops now for people that don't want to have to invest the time in like putting Graphene OS on a phone themselves or, you know, learning, you know, all this, you know, learning a Linux necessarily. Like they make it really easy. And there's, you know, there's never been a better time to do that than now, because, you know, if you see where Microsoft's going, you're not going to be able to keep access to your own data unless, you know, you avoid committing thought crime. Yeah. For Microsoft. I mean, that's just nuts.
No, and to continue mapping this out for people, like going back to StartOS, it's created by a company called Start9 Labs, and they're essentially creating an operating system that will allow you to self-host all of your stuff. So you'll have a server at your house. They partner with Purism to get their operating system out of the box. You can buy one of the Purism laptops if you want to. You can buy a Purism server, plug it in, and then it's plug and play. You get the de-Googled, de-Apple, de-Microsoft software suite, and then you can host all of your data on your own machine, your pictures, your files. You don't have to send it to the cloud and feed the AI superstructure that's trying to take your life over.
Man, and the AI stuff is legit insane. So Catherine Austin Fitz, who runs the Solari Report, and is awesome in general, and has done a lot of great interviews about CBDCs and the BIS and all of that, asked me to write a piece for their new issue on artificial intelligence. And so I decided to write about something I've wanted to do for a while, though it's kind of torturous, which is to read the book on AI written by Henry Kissinger and former Google CEO Eric Schmidt. And, you know, I wasn't really surprised for what I found. It's fucking nuts. And so my piece for them is titled The Final Coup, because I think that's really what it is. So, you know, Henry Kissinger, what has his whole career been, really? So he ran the State Department and he was like, you know, an operator for groups like the Trilateral Commission and a lot of these other entities that want like global technocracy as sort of designed by groups like the Rockefellers, you know, for quite a long time. And at the State Department, you know, sort of turned using the State Department into an engine for coup d'etats, you know, into an art form. And then, of course, he leaves the State Department, but essentially trains up most of the other subsequent secretaries of state, including people like Hillary Clinton, for example, among others, of course, who would then go on and do regime change. So, you know, he's a coup guy. You know, and definitely very into realpolitik and all of these things, and a war criminal, and obviously doesn't care about the little people. I think one of his more infamous quotes is about, you know, calling U.S. soldiers like dumb beasts that are like pawns for the people that actually, you know, decide what happens in the world. So definitely an elitist worldview. And you also find that in this book. And it's crazy. So, I mean, it basically... there's all these different parts to it, I guess. But essentially, their argument is something like AI is going to be so much smarter than us that it's going to be able to see aspects of reality that we can't see. But we should definitely trust that whatever it tells us is in this invisible hidden reality is totally reality and not just some AI hallucination, which is like an actual term. Like that's a real phenomenon where AI presents something totally false and provably false as fact, right? So it can very easily be, you know, whatever this quote unquote reality is that AI is identifying is delusional or just made up. It only exists in the mind, quote unquote, of the AI, right? So anyway, they don't bring that up in their book at all. They just say AI is going to allow us to pursue this awesome quest for super knowledge, and we're going to be able to see unseen realities, but there's a trade-off, they say. And the trade-off is that in order to unlock AI's full potential, we have to essentially sell off our ability to perceive reality, and we have to use AI as we're use it, you know, as not just as we're using it now, but deepen that involvement to the point where we're essentially dependent on AI to make decisions for us, and we become cognitively diminished by AI, meaning that, you know, we aren't using our brains like we did before to make decisions and reason and perceive reality. And so AI, the machine, is doing all of that for us. That's sort of what they envision. And that's very dystopian. But then you read on and they start essentially talking about this two-tier society model. So basically they're like, well, this AI quote unquote revolution will be very empowering for some people, you know, the policymakers, the heads of multinational corporations, the people who design AI and code it and task it and regulate it. They'll find this very empowering. But then the people who, you know, consume AI from, you know, the consumer level, or are just sort of, you know, not part of that other tier, everyone else really, will be bewildered by its opaque decision-making and, you know, will be disempowered or find it disconcerting and won't really have any control over their lives anymore. And then over time will cease to be able to realize what's happening to them. And, I mean, that's literally what the book is about. It's very nuts. And talks about, you know, AI is basically going to draw people, mainly this disempowered class, into a new version of reality that is essentially being designed by the empowered class, right? The technocrats, I guess you could call them. It's very like Matrix-esque, and very creepy. And a lot of it also has to do with what they say is going to be AI control over the information space. And of course, that's going to really come into its own once both AI and the internet are heavily regulated by a centralized authority, which is what the UN is gearing up to do next year. What do you know?
What are they gearing up to, like, set the rules for, all right, here's how you interact with it? Because
yes, for AI for everyone globally, a new UN agency, and it's backed by all the big AI companies like Sam Altman's OpenAI, among others.
It's completely disgusting.
One centralized authority to control all AI. And, you know, the goal is to have this AI not just censor information, like it's doing now on social media, for example. They want it to basically write all of the information. So basically people will be, you know, on the new internet, you know, they'll be consuming information, but it'll all be written by AI essentially. That's like essentially what they want to do as they map it out. Have it like basically shape people's minds and make people control how people receive reality by dominating the information space. And all the information people have access to and like everything they see and do, hence the whole like push into augmented reality, Neuralink. I mean, that's like the final phase, I guess, of all of this. But, you know, it's to basically deepen our dependence on this stuff and have the algorithm continue to choose for us to a point where we don't even know how to choose for ourselves anymore. But again, that's for the plebs. There's this other class that's going to be cognitively enhanced and be making all the decisions and directing how, you know, AI develops and whatever.
Have you been following the debate between closed source AI and open source AI?
No, not really.
So the idea is that there's a battle within AI right now. If AI is here and it's going to be here, moving forward, we're at a critical point in the history of artificial intelligence where we really need open source large language models and training models to outcompete the OpenAIs, Microsofts, Googles of the world, and essentially give the plebs the power of AI hosted on their own servers so that they can avoid the walled garden closed source structure provided by the OpenAIs of the world. It's very confusing because it's OpenAI, but it's closed source.
You have
Sam Altman and Google and Microsoft going in front of Congress a few months ago and basically saying, yes, please regulate us. Let us create this regulatory moat so that we are the gatekeepers of artificial intelligence.
Yeah. Anytime the private, super powerful corporate world goes like, regulate me harder, daddy, in front of Congress, you know, there is fuckery afoot for sure. I mean, basically what you have to keep in mind here, and a lot of people forget this too, Silicon Valley, pretty much all of those main companies were made by like intelligence services or the military or with funding from one or two, or if they weren't initially, are now contractors and all intertwined with the national security state. So, okay. I mean, that's why we have these things like people now getting upset about Facebook censoring stuff, but Facebook, you know, was essentially tied up with DARPA and, you know, the CIA through Peter Thiel, from the very beginning. Right. So is it really that surprising that they would censor on behalf of the state? No, they're an independent private company. No, that's like a total, that's a lie. Like the whole thing about Silicon Valley being all these like humble entrepreneurs tinkering around in their garage and look at what we've made with the American entrepreneurial spirit. I mean, that's such bullshit. Like if you look into any of these big companies, you always had, you know, these powerful entities of the state there. And so they're extensions of state power. Even if you want to think that they weren't necessarily at the origins, you can't deny that now. I mean, they fused, essentially. That's why you have people like Eric Schmidt, which is why reading this book is really important. This is the most influential guy on AI policy in the U.S. right now. He's funding salaries of like all of the Biden administration's top AI people. It's totally illegal for him to do that, but he's doing it. And even like mainstream media, like Politico's reporting on it, and nothing's happened. It's crazy. It's just, he's in charge. And he ran the National Security Commission on AI, which basically laid out all of the policies. And that commission was the CIA and people tied up with the CIA, like former heads of NQTEL that are very close friends of Schmidt, military people that are also tied up with Schmidt because he used to be head of the, not the head, but used to be involved with the Defense Innovation Board. And then, you know, the big Silicon Valley companies, Amazon, Microsoft, all of those guys deciding what happens. I mean, they're really the same entity at this point because they're all either military intelligence contractors. And you can't really decide where one ends and the other one ends. And you have all of these Silicon Valley billionaires, you know, they fund Congress essentially at this point, or the DNC or the RNC. So, you know, the national security state Silicon Valley blob is what runs the US, and they're going to have their AI. And so they're really, I think what's going on now in terms of the battles of AI, well, I mean, sure, there's this open source component, but there also is this competition over like which elite faction, you know, essentially, you know, there's this blob in the US and there's also like a BRICS blob, I guess, you know, like in China, for example, of their tech companies, you know, who's going to get their AI adopted by emerging markets in the global South. And that's where a lot of the focus is to do all this stuff, you know, in Latin America, Africa, Southeast Asia. Yeah, I don't know. Definitely something to look at there in terms of the dynamics, because they talk pretty openly about it. But the justification that, you know, these groups like Schmidt's group give for, you know, winning that factional battle is in order to beat China, we have to become China, and we have to compete with China's what they call the China's civil military fusion model, which is, you know, civilian sector, the private sector, and the military are fused in China. They're working together towards this goal. So, you know, the US has to develop a model equivalent to that, which is, That is fascism. That is straight up fascism, guys. And that is what Eric Schmidt, who is basically one of the people puppeteering the Biden administration, because obviously Joe Biden is not in charge of shit, you know, is that's what he wants to do now, with now the U.S. And
I was going to say, now that you mention it, it's pretty hilarious because the effort that the government's putting in to put up a facade that there is some separation between the government and the private sector. It's like, Kamala Harris is our AI czar. It's like, what? Like, what the fuck does she know about AI?
No. No, I mean, you know. Yeah, that's nuts. Yeah, the AI czar is actually Eric Schmidt. They just won't tell you because he's funding all their experts and, like, developing all the policies with, like, his people. It's like, he's like single-handedly funding most of the Federation of American Scientists and stuff. I mean, it's just unreal. But then at the same time, you know, you have the Schmidt crowd and then you have the Peter Thiel crowd, right? And the Peter Thiel crowd is very involved in the development of this AI weapon and AI surveillance technology. They've been testing a lot of it out in Ukraine and are going to be testing it out in the Middle East now for sure.
Yeah. And I saw in your newsletter, wasn't you wrote an article about it, but I can't recall her name, but was diving into Anduril.
Strevula Pabst, yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And yeah, Anduril Palmer-Luckey, who created Oculus, went and started this private defense company. And
yeah. Well, Palmer-Luckey was a Thiel fellow, right? So he got a bunch of money from Peter Thiel, and then he makes Oculus Rift, and then it gets bought by Facebook, where Peter Thiel has been sort of directing, at least in the early days, was very involved in directing stuff as their first big investor. And at the same time, he was making the CIA front, otherwise known as Palantir. Yeah, a lot of interesting stuff happening there, obviously. And now Palmer-Luckey is running Anduril, which is, you know, making a lot of this AI weapon stuff for the military, but also a lot of it has been already set up, that tech, on the U.S.-Mexico border, to like basically autonomously, you know, do border control stuff. And they're not stopping people from coming in. So it's very possible that it's mainly there to stop people from leaving at some point, not to black pill people, but, sorry.
No, but cause it's funny. Cause I was at an event a few weeks ago and Anduril was a point of topic, and the way it's being pitched is like, hey, if you're conservative, you don't like the big military budget, Anduril is going to be able to accomplish what the U.S. military can accomplish with 2% of the budget. And that's how people
are getting autonomous drones that, you know, don't really have that much human oversight. And I mean, that the Ukrainian military is doing that now. I don't think it's necessarily with Anduril drones, even though Anduril drones are like used by the Ukrainian military, but they're like, they've gotten rid of human oversight on some of their drone attacks now. That is so bad. I mean, that's like Skynet level crap. We should not be supporting that. And I mean, I don't know. I think it's silly that there's like libertarian leaning people that fall for this. Cause it's like, aren't you empowering the state with like doom weapons? Like, shouldn't you not?
But it's cheaper. I don't know. It's cheaper. We save tax money.
Yeah. That's well, I mean, pitched. I know. Well, they always have their pitch, right? It's cheaper, it's easier, it's more convenient. But what will you lose? Human oversight over war? The AI deciding who lives and who dies? Okay. I don't like that trade-off, personally. And no, also, I mean, the wars, why aren't people remembering that the whole point is that the wars are banker wars? Yeah. So like, oh, okay, the banker wars will be cheaper. What a win. You know, I don't really see that as being good. Why don't we destroy the bankers and then their wars will stop?
Well, that's I watched the 45-minute documentary on the banker wars after shit started popping up in Israel and Palestine. I forget if it was in that or continued falling down a rabbit hole, but you mentioned it in the beginning of the show. We should probably get back to like the origins of Zionism. Was you had Mayor Rothschild, or one of the Rothschilds, at the beginning of the story.
Let's go back farther. So, again, go to mintpressnews.com, search for my old article, The Untold, I think Untold Story or Untold History of Christian Zionism. That's one of the two. So Christian Zionism, and really Christian Zionism precedes Zionism. Yeah. So the founding father of Zionism, sorry, my cough keeps coming back. The founding father of Zionism is Theodor Herzl, who wrote this book called The Jewish State. I don't know. I was either the end of the 19th century or early 20th century, but the Puritans back in the 17th century in Britain and then later in the American colonies were calling for a Jewish ethno-state in Palestine back then as a necessary requisite to fulfill end times prophecy, so that basically we need to make this happen so Jesus will come back. That was the mentality there. And then, you know, it didn't really get that far with the Puritans alone, but then you have this one guy come on the scene who's a British preacher, John Nelson Darby, I think is his name, if I remember correctly. Sorry, I mean, I wrote about this stuff a few years ago, so I don't may get a little weird on the names, but he basically developed, I think it's called Christian dispensationalism, which sort of divides history into different eras. Like, so now we're in the messianic era and all of that. And he also developed the rapture as a thing. So, you know, the rapture is very common in American Christianity, but it didn't exist until the early 1800s. No one believed in it before, and it has no scriptural basis. It doesn't. There's no scriptural basis for the rapture in the Bible. There's nothing that says it anywhere. Just letting people know. Because there's a lot of people that are like in this messianic movement within Christian Zionism. Oh, we have to, all this stuff has to be happen to be fulfilled, because once it happens, you know, there'll be the third temple, when it's there, will trigger the beginning of the tribulation, and the rapture has to happen before the tribulation, so we won't be here and we won't have to suffer all this stuff that we helped create. Okay, but no one believed in the rapture until the 1800s, and it was this one guy in his church that developed it. So it's not in the Bible. So try not to make hell on earth, please. That's what I'm trying to get at there. Anyway, so this guy became really influential, and it kind of spread all over the place. And you basically had a couple different things happen in the 1800s. But one that's really important is that you start having like elite people in America and Britain getting really involved with this idea of an ethno-state, a Jewish ethno-state in Palestine. And it was at the time completely rejected by the Jewish community globally, really. Not into it at all. And so you had, there's this one rabbi that was sort of into it. Kalischer is his last name. And he sort of developed this movement, but it was very fringe at the time in Judaism, that we can't wait for God to fulfill the messianic era. So we have to hasten the coming of the Jewish Messiah. And this sort of torch has been picked up since by the Chabad Lubavitch movement, which is very, very influential, by the way. So for example, in the Trump administration, you have Mike Pence and you have Mike Pompeo, but Jared Kushner is very tied up with the Chabad Lubavitch movement. So is Netanyahu. So is Robert Maxwell, and a lot of different powerful actors over the years. Anyway, getting ahead of myself. Sorry. So Kalischer wrote a letter in like 1830 something to one of the Rothschilds. Yeah. And then the guy, Charles Taze Russell, that later creates this church that becomes the Jehovah's Witnesses, also writes to the Rothschilds asking for an ethno-state in Palestine. And there's a few of these letters that are written, and then eventually you get the Balfour Declaration in like 1917. But before then, you get something called the Blackstone Memorial, which is like at the end of the 1800s, you have a letter from some of the most powerful people in the United States, none of them Jewish, really. Well, there might have been a, you know, out of 100 something signatories, like a handful of Jewish people, calling, it was written to the Secretary of State of the U.S. at the time. I forget who was president. But they're calling for the establishment of the state in Palestine. And this is all before Theodor Herzl, right, was even around. And the people that signed that Blackstone Memorial, it's J.P. Morgan, J.D. Rockefeller, members of Congress, mayors of New York and Boston, Supreme Court justices. I mean, like, super powerful people. They're all, you know, WASPs. They're not Jewish people, right? And they're saying, we need this to happen. And then if you look into the history of Theodor Herzl himself, his whole movement was shaped by a British guy who I think was stationed at the British embassy in Austria, William Heckler, who was like a total, I mean, he's a Freemason, totally obsessed with the Third Temple, had like replicas of the Third Temple in his office, was just totally obsessed with it, and felt like the ethnostate and Jewish ethnostate in Palestine had to happen for the end times. He's the guy that like gets, sort of mentors Herzl in some ways, connects him with powerful political people, specifically like in Germany and in that part of Europe, and like basically gives his movement, the early Zionist movement, political legitimacy, which of course later develops. And then you have powerful people in countries around the world, Europe and also the US, people like Louis Brandeis, for example, who are Jewish, who become very involved in the Zionist movement. But it took a while for people who were actually Jewish to want the ethnostate in Palestine. And you don't really have mass support for it in the Jewish community until after World War II. So there's a lot of powerful actors that wanted this to happen for very particular reasons a long, long time ago, and not necessarily because they think it's best for the Jewish community. So again, definitely go and read that article, because I mean, I'm just paraphrasing it and I wrote it 4 years ago, you know, but this history is really important because you have a lot of people who still feel that way guiding current events, and it's not for the benefit of Jewish people or for the Palestinians or for Christians or any of these people. You know, it's an obsession with the apocalypse, and people really need to look into this because, I personally don't want to have the apocalypse happen and blow up everything because people think it's going to bring their Messiah back. Well,
yeah, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy with no good outcome.
Yeah. It's like, this whole thing of like, let's play God. I mean, you see it with transhumanism too. Let's become the gods now. And then these other people in this arena are like, well, let's not wait for God to do it. Let's take matters into our own hands and force him to do stuff. It doesn't work that way, guys.
Yeah. I'm just envisioning the domino meme where it's like some dude invents the idea of the rapture in the 17th century. And then the big domino is like nuclear holocaust in 2024 or something like that.
Well, it's like sad because there are like so many people that are like, it doesn't matter all the bloodshed in Israel and Palestine. And what happens as a consequence of it in World War III, let's support all of that because I'm going to get raptured out of here. Dude, it's not in the Bible. This one guy made it up. And if you look into him, he was like not a normal dude. Yeah. And I guess one figure I didn't really bring up in terms of the Christian Zionism thing was the guy that really popularized that outside, like among the masses. So before this view, right, you know, J.D. Rockefeller, J.P. Morgan, it was like very among the American elites, and there's also a lot of overlap with Freemasonry. So Charles Taze Russell, who I mentioned earlier, the guy that, you know, helped create the Jehovah's Witnesses, look up where he's buried and what his tombstone looks like. Just leave it there. Definitely an interesting fellow who happens to be buried under a giant Masonic pyramid.
Wait, what was his name?
Whatever.
James Russell?
Taze Russell, T-A-Z-E.
Charles Taze, look up the tomb. Logan, we're going
to
pull this
up. He would give like these big stadium speeches to Christians and Jews alike saying, we got to make a Jewish ethnostate in Palestine, like in at the end of the 19th century and stuff. I mean, people overlook this stuff, but I mean, these are definitely influential people. But anyway, the guy I didn't mention who's really influential is a guy named Cyrus Schofield, who wrote the Schofield Reference Bible. And if you look at into, yeah, there it is. I mean, totally normal dude wants to be buried under that, you know?
Jesus Christ.
Whatever. Yeah.
Sorry for interrupting.
No, not interrupting at all. Yeah, so the Schofield Reference Bible guy, basically Cyrus Schofield had to leave where he was originally from because of corruption scandals, and like he abandoned his wife and daughters and was a drunk and was basically an all-around piece of shit. And eventually he gets involved with some like elite people, even though he's like sort of tried to revive himself as a different kind of, I guess, preacher, getting into this Christian dispensationalist movement that I talked about earlier. And then he, you know, out of nowhere, this like small town preacher gets invited to join this like really exclusive secret society in New York called the Lotus Club. And where like Andrew Carnegie and the Vanderbilts and all these guys were members. So like, what is he doing there? And that club ended up financing him to write what is called the Scofield Reference Bible, and then arranged for him to go to England, where he got the first reference Bible printed by Oxford University. And then thanks to all these elite connections, it was basically became like the main Bible used in seminaries throughout the United States. And I think also in the UK. And this is important because this Bible is it's the King James Version, but it's like annotated by Cyrus Scofield, even though he wasn't a trained theologian. And had started off like, you know, having all these issues with like forging documents and bribing people. And like, yeah. So anyway, that's his background. But he's interpreting all this stuff, and it basically became the standard for a lot of seminaries in the U.S. And that's how it sort of got out. And so a lot of interpretations of the Bible come from that are, you know, things like that you hear from a lot of Christian Zionists, like if you curse Israel, you will be cursed. And if you bless Israel, you'll be blessed, which by these groups becomes something like, if you criticize Israel, you're cursing Israel. And so you're going against the Bible by saying anything negative about Israel's government. Right. And it goes back to that. And it comes from the Scofield Reference Bible. Very weird. I don't know. It's definitely worth looking into Cyrus Scofield and who he was. Because, you know, whether you're a Christian or not, I think honestly this history matters. And I think especially if you're a Christian, it matters. Because, you know, you should be concerned with, you know, the lack of, how should I phrase this? Like, the focus of Christianity, in my opinion, should be, you know, as close to the truth as Jesus taught it. Right. Not necessarily like people like John Nelson Darby and all these guys in the 1800s and Cyrus Scofield adding their interpretations to it. Like maybe you should go back earlier before like all these centuries of like corrupt Catholic popes and then, you know, corrupt people like Cyrus Scofield started interpreting stuff for, you know, their political benefit, you know? So, yeah. I mean, it's definitely worth considering some of this stuff. You know what I mean? So again, if you want to know how the Middle East is going to play out, or at least rather where they're going to try and take this, definitely look into the stuff, because it's been going on for a long time, and it definitely precedes Theodore Herzl and all of that stuff to a significant degree. And this same line of thinking is still influencing events today.
Lineage of radical Christians trying to bring about the rapture is why we're...
It's not just Christians, though.
Yeah.
It's like there's people in Israel and people in the U.S. and arguably beyond. I mean, I'm not, you know, I haven't like studied Islam that extensively. Like, so a lot of this line of research at Mint Press happened because I like majored in religion in college. So I had a lot of background. But I never really have studied Islam, but I know there's like messianic varieties of Islam as well. So it's very possible that like on their side, they also sort of want to bring out their Messiah too. I mean, it's more than possible. You know, you have all these different groups pushing for their different end time scenarios that they think are going to favor them in some way. But again, to go back to this quote from Gareth Icke that I sort of said earlier, let's get off the chessboard, stop playing these guys' game, because it's very bloody and it's very nasty. It's very against human freedom and the values that I think most, you know, sane people share, right?
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, going back to like the Bible, like an eye for an eye will make the whole world blind. I'm not sure if that's the Bible or...
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's sort of essentially happening now in terms of justifying, you know, what's going on with Israel and Palestine and like the increasing escalations. Right.
Yeah.
So
no, it's been crazy to see just like the vitriol spreading. Like we had protests here in the U.S., the Capitol building yesterday, embassies around the world. Everybody is out looking for blood. And like you said, I don't know how we can do it, but it definitely needs to happen. It's like, hey, people, everybody walk off the chessboard. You're being manipulated. And going back to...
Well, you may not be able to convince other people to walk off the chessboard, but definitely don't feed in to, like, the extreme, let's get all divided in anger, hate, and anyone that doesn't believe what I believe is a terrorist mentality. Like, that is so not helpful. And it's, you know, it was totally what was not helpful about COVID, too, you know?
You know, and it is helpful to,
like, you didn't get the vax, you're a biosecurity threat to me, yeah, and my family and my grandma, you know, I mean,
and now it's becoming clear what was promised, that this wasn't gene therapy, is it's becoming clear that there was a lot of DNA that was not supposed to be in those vials.
Well, this is what happens when you trust the craziest people at DARPA in the military to make a vaccine for you without any sort of safety studies of any meaning and oversight. Hey, they call it Operation Warp Speed.
They jabbed a dozen mice. It looked good. Looked good in the mice.
Yep. Yeah, I think how many days did they like follow up on the mice too? I feel like it was like not long. No. You know, sort of like those Monsanto Roundup studies where they like knew that the mice were all going to get tumors after like 3 months. And so they made sure the study only lasted 2 months.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But it's, and it is,
but trust the science.
Well, trust the science. And then like, just,
you know, cause it's not like science can be manipulated by the people who manipulate literally everything.
I mean, and the whole, it's hilarious going back to the lack of critical thinking that exists in the world and the attempt to diminish that even further with AI. It's like science is literally don't trust anything, like test. It's like,
no, literally AI is being set up to be like the mother of all psyops. It's like, use AI to like put out a bunch of content, pretend it's people, like just give people crazy information overload so they're totally bewildered. And then depend on another AI to filter out the news for you and tell you what you should believe. They literally say that in the book, and that's like what's happening. It's nuts.
That's where, I mean, things like Noster, that's what I think it's going to have to get to, is literally when you send a message out on the internet, and I don't, this is a problem that still hasn't been solved yet, but you should have something equivalent to a YubiKey that has a private key on it and that you sign and attest to the message, like, this actually came from me, the physical human being. And if I don't have this PGP signature or this private key signed next to anything I put on the internet, it's not me. It's likely a bot.
Well, it's definitely going to be superior to former Twitter, which is, you know,
X.
Verify all humans.
Well, they just came out with their new privacy policy. They just came out with the privacy policy where they're going to feed all the information into their AI. I'm like, oh. Except,
oh, doesn't Elon Musk back OpenAI? I'm so shocked.
Well, apparently he backed away
from it. Oh, no, but he has another AI company that he's made, too. That's going to be all tied into the X super family of companies.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm sure you've been paying attention, but you can see the light nudging that's happening on X to really cattle herd people to, like, never leave the platform. Like, the one change they made 2 weeks ago, which is, like, if you have a link going outside of the site, it's just, like, a picture. It doesn't even have, like, an article, subtitle, and metadata. It's
only going to get worse. Yeah. It's only going to get worse. And there's a lot of people who, like, just can't live without social media. So, like, they'll just stay forever and get psyoped into oblivion by AI. Uh-oh.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on Noster? Yeah. I know you're on there. We talked about it briefly in the past.
Yeah, I've been kind of tied up for like 3 or 4 months, so I haven't really gotten to like use it or really Twitter much. I'm kind of avoiding it because it not Noster necessarily, but like Twitter, just because you know. I mean, just social media in general can be just kind of exhausting. And obviously the algorithm is Well, for people that don't remember, like Facebook and some of these other companies got caught like tweaking their algorithm to like manipulate your emotions, mm-hmm. mainly to make you feel like shit, basically. So I'm pretty sure they still do that, whether it's Twitter or elsewhere.
Twitter, I had to stop looking at Twitter as much because the For You tab for me is literally all murder videos. I'm like, I don't want to watch murder.
Yeah, a lot of it is like, yeah, so I wasn't enjoying it either and was like, nah, I don't need this. And so, you know, if I want to tweet something, I'll like, you know, it'll be tweeted, but I'm not reading anything on it anymore.
Yeah.
Because, all right, so, you know, after reading this book by Kissinger and Schmidt, basically, who were basically the intellectual architects of current U.S. AI policy, and when you consider that, like, the U.S. military literally, like almost 10 years ago, started studying how to use social media to, their words, control humans like drones. Okay. definitely want to keep your perception of reality yours. You know what I mean? If the goal of AI for them is to have AI control how you perceive reality and that you stop being able to do that yourself, I mean, that's like the ultimate mind control and population control. That's what this is about. And they openly say in the book, this has major implications for free societies and even free will. Okay. And it's pretty clear what they want out of this. So the best way to, you know, fight against that, at least on an individual level, is to keep your mind your own. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that means having very robust critical thinking skills and not having political saviors that you just believe whatever they say, and also not being online 100% of the time.
Yeah. Do you have any hope that everything they're attempting to do, from the CBDC to AI to this tearing down and rebuilding of the temple, it's just too much for them to control and contain at this point, and that they're going to lose control, that people are going to recognize, like, all right,
totally,
what the hell just happened? Because it seems like it's becoming extremely overwhelming to an extent.
Too many moving parts, and they can't manage it all, which I think is part of why they're so desperate to get AI to a certain point, too, because they have to have AI manage a lot of it. Okay, but this is where freedom tech people need to get creative, because it's not enough just to develop stuff where you're like, okay, I want to make alternatives to existing big tech products. Like, how do you not only divest from big tech AI products, how do you help fuck up big tech AI products? You know?
Make them hallucinate
faster.
Like, how can
you feed Microsoft's AI a bunch of bullshit data that is basically like throwing a wrench in its algorithm?
Yeah.
For example. Right. I mean, you know, this is an info war, but it's like, it's a tech war. There's a lot going on. And so, like, maybe we're the underdogs, but at the same time, these guys have taken on a lot more than they can chew. For sure.
Yeah.
And I think they're, you know, very confident they're going to be able to control stuff, and AI is going to be able to do this and that. But okay, so just like every industry that like these guys control, there's a lot of corruption. Like, a lot of AI companies oversell their AI and their algorithms, you know? So like, I wrote about one in 2020 with COVID. This Israeli company got this contract in Rhode Island to like predict COVID outbreaks before they happen. Yeah. And based on the company, and this is like not audited by anyone independent, this is like the company statistic, they said that their AI was like 73% accurate. Right? So if it's audited independently and it's like 50%, it's like flipping a coin. How is that useful? Right? So like, there's a lot of grift, just like all the industries that these guys, I mean, because it's all about money and power, right? They often create inferior products because of the obsession with money and power. So, like, there's problems with their AI. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I do think at some point, though, based on what is in this Kissinger book, they're probably going to try and fake artificial, like, general artificial intelligence or whatever, like the singularity. They might fake that and try and make this new, like, AI-driven religion and stuff. and the dataism religion thing that, like, Yuval Noah Harari is really into. I mean, they might try and go that route, but I doubt it will be. I mean, it won't be real. I mean, it'll just be a psyop.
Sam Altman's come out and said that they've discovered AGI internally in OpenAI already.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So that's amazing. Okay. So, well, amazing in the sense that, like, it's hilarious and he's full of shit.
Logan, see if you can find that on Twitter.
Yeah, I'll have to look that up. So I did a video with my friend Ryan Christian a while ago when Google covertly tried to do the same thing with their large language model, Lambda. I don't know if you remember, there was an engineer that got coverage in, like, the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times being like, it's sentient, guys. And he had, like, these chat logs, and then a few months later had to admit that he, like, forged the chat logs, and it was, like, all bullshit. But there was this huge, like, media push, like, AI is sentient, the singularity's here, and all these people got, like, jacked up on it, you know?
Yeah.
But there's, like, a whole effort, I think, to basically, you know, do, you know, just fake it, basically. Because once you have people being like, oh, there's this new great intelligence, a lot of the stuff that's posited in the Schmidt-Kissinger book becomes a lot easier to implement. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I found a tweet.
And
so
it doesn't have to be real.
No. So, like, here, pull this up, Logan. Apparently it was Sam Altman in a Reddit thread, basically saying AGI has been achieved internally. There is a community note on this tweet saying that he responded saying, I was just joking.
Right. Okay. Well, okay. You know, just like, I think it's a good rule to, like, never trust the Fed or Jamie Dimon. I also don't think it's a good idea to ever trust the WorldCoin dweeb. So like, he's probably full of shit. Yeah. Sorry. He's, like, literally running a scam, stealing people's biometric data and selling and giving them shit coins in return. Like,
have you seen the
probably
allegations?
Wouldn't believe the guy. He's, like, a clear grifter.
And
sorry.
Have you seen the allegations from his sister?
Oh, no. More stuff to look up. Look at me.
allegations. I don't want to get in trouble for slander or anything, but apparently his sister has been on Twitter for a year saying that he molested her when they were younger.
Oh, no, I did not know that.
Yeah.
But
that's being swept under the rug pretty aggressively.
Oh, gross. Yeah. Well, he's gross. I can't say it really shocks me that there's a high possibility he might be grosser than I previously thought, I guess. Yeah. But basically, you know, I think they're going to fake this singularity thing to sort of get people to jump on the AI bandwagon and be like, okay, let's put it in charge of everything. Because that's what they want. But frankly, it's like, you know, like I said earlier, I don't think it's really working the way they want. And ultimately, you know, if they get the singularity or they convince people they get it, they can do, like, this whole, like, Wizard of Oz thing, right? Where basically, like, they're the men behind the curtain and there's this AI, and, like, AI issues all these, like, edicts and diktats. And, like, oh, well, AI is super intelligent and way smarter than us, so we got to do whatever the AI says, guys. You know? But I mean, it could just be like Henry Kissinger and Eric Schmidt behind the curtain being like, let's carpet bomb Iran, you know, and
you should only
the
have
AI
one
says
kid.
It. And yeah, eat the bugs, whatever. Like, AI says it all. It's for the good. It's the super intelligence. So we just got to do whatever it says. And, you know, they say in their book, too, and a lot of other, like, AI experts and thinkers, you know, AI doesn't have logic or, you know, think, quote unquote, like humans do. So it can't explain how it reaches its conclusions, you know? So it's all this opaque decision making. Computer says no, and that's it, right? But they don't have to have actual singularity, actual intelligence. They just fake it and act like AI is doing all that stuff, but it's really just them being like, oh, cool, now we have carte blanche to do whatever the F we want, you know, and have no accountability or ever have to explain ourselves again. If you're the elite, would you want that?
Oh,
would you fake the singularity to get that? Yes, especially if you know you can't achieve the singularity because you're overestimating AI and overhyping it all the time.
Yeah. Well, it's like,
I mean, AI can do some stuff good, but yeah, it can't do everything they say it can do.
No. And that's why it's conflicting to me, and why I brought up the open source versus closed source battle that's going on right now to you, because I get value, particularly for image generation for the website, for thumbnails. It does produce pretty cool images. And there are Stable Diffusion models, open source models that I can run on my own server and sort of train it with our brand aesthetic to like pump out thumbnails very easily. And for me, I don't have the money to hire a designer and to do that, or the time to mm-hmm. do that. And so like that provides value to me. And I could see a scenario in which mm-hmm. I have my own hosted AI model on my own computer that I control that doesn't connect to the outside world. And I just feed it data and say, hey, help me sort of crunch these numbers and give me back an income statement balance sheet with the financials that sit on my server. Like, and do that quickly. Like, that could be valuable to me. And other things
sure.
too.
Like, well, I'm not saying AI is bad. I'm saying the worst people in the world are making a bunch of AIs right now, and they want to put the AIs they make in charge of everything.
Yes.
That's bad.
That is terrible.
Precisely because they're the worst people in the world, right? So, you know, that's like my main point here. Like, I'm not trying to be like a Luddite or saying like, don't use technology, whatever, but you have to be responsible, and you have to be very like aware of the plans of these people and how they plan to use those technologies, and also how they plan to regulate them. And if they plan to make your ability to, you know, do what you just mentioned with AI illegal, right?
Yeah.
Because they want to make financial anonymity illegal. They want to keep control of all of these tools in the technology and centralize it. Right. So, I mean, they might try and go that route. I mean, I don't really know.
Oh,
but
they're definitely going to. I mean, that's why Sam Altman's in front of Congress. Why the Google people in front of Congress. I mean, it's so crazy how, and that's why I think your statement is that they're really rushing this because they think they're losing control holds a lot of weight in my mind. It's because the fact that AI became popular this time last year, and then not even a year later, less than 10 months later, you have all the heads of AI on Congress being like, regulate me harder, daddy. Don't let anybody else use this.
Yeah.
It's a very accelerated pace.
Exactly.
Like it went from nothing to an existential crisis in 7 months.
Yeah, and it's going to, I'm telling you, next year's going to be even faster than this year. It's going to be nuts. There's going to be a lot of stuff popping off.
Yeah.
So
we're going to have the
great
election.
Time to get ready.
The great election to distract all of us and divide and confuse people in the middle of all of it.
If you want to take what's coming seriously, treat what's happening with the election as the political circus that it is and give it the amount of your attention it deserves, which is not much. Yeah. People, I think, should honestly be focusing on like how to divest from the people trying to enslave us and get prepared for what's to come.
Yeah. No, I mean, even this
and
week.
And not being like.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
No, I was going to say just even this week, I don't want to call what's happening. I don't want to diminish what's happening in the Middle East and label it as a distraction, but like here in the US, like the financial system, something broke on the back end of the financial system. It's very obvious if you look at like interest rates and price of gold. And then on top of that, on the civil liberty side of things, they just jailed that guy, James Mackey, I believe his name, or Douglas Mackey, for 7 months for making a meme about Hillary Clinton in the 2016 election.
Right.
And mm-hmm. so, like, you have, like, political dissidents getting thrown in the gulag. Obviously, all the January 6 people have been thrown in the gulag.
Here's the other thing I forgot to bring up about WEFPAC, which is involved with the UN and Interpol, too, because Interpol's a big part of it. And that's important because it's not just about online and financial anonymity, like, eliminating that. It's also about labeling people that go against that ban as cyber criminals. And you can also be a cyber criminal for publishing misinformation online, right? And there's this push at the UN under SDG 16, which is also the SDG that digital ID is folded in and all this other stuff is, to basically, you know, prosecute cyber criminals globally and have Interpol go after people, like empower Interpol to do that, which is part of WEFPAC, and the DOJ for people in the US, also part of it. All very bad, right? So anyway, Interpol developed its sustainable policing goals. I mean, I wish I was making this up, but it's to complement the sustainable development goals. And it's about deciding who's a cyber criminal and who's not. And basically, again, people that publish wrong think online, people that facilitate, you know, privacy enhancing technologies that could be used for money laundering, you know.
Yeah,
well, all that stuff. And I mean, they've already been doing this in like the crypto space for a while. Like anyone, like going after people that, you know, developed mixers and stuff like this. Or,
yeah. But this week too, they tried to like pin Bitcoin as supporting Hamas, and like the best evidence they had, they were like, this one wallet got $2,000. It's like, what? Like they rolled in with the guns you gave Ukraine. Like, what the hell are you talking about?
Yeah, no, I know. So like before this happened, this conflict happened, I gave this speech in May in Miami, right? And I was like referencing all these headlines saying that the next frontier in terrorism is Bitcoin and the dark web. It's been all over the place for years. They're going to come after it. And it's not like it's just like, they're going to illegalize Bitcoin or anything. I think they're going to try and co-opt what they can out of Bitcoin and then try and negate the potential Bitcoin has to be a tool for financial freedom, basically.
Yeah, that's why I completely agree with you. It is our job as people fighting to bring freedom tech to the world, Bitcoin being one of those technologies that we have to get serious
so,
and really batten down the hatches.
So for like the Bitcoin, community, there's like really two camps as I see it. There's the people that are like, I'm into Bitcoin because I think it's going to make me shitloads of money and I can't wait for $1 million Bitcoin and yada, yada, yada. Yeah. And then there's the people who are like, I'm in Bitcoin because I want to destroy the bankers and their hold on society and return financial freedom to the people. There is only one side there that's legitimate.
Yeah.
And there's only one side there that is like deserving of respect. And the other people might as well go work for Jamie Dimon and fuck off.
Yeah. Well, that is one of the memes in Bitcoin, is you come to get rich, but you stay for the revolution. So I do agree those two sides exist, but I think the more people spend.
Well, I mean, you can look at it as a money thing, but if you give no crap about the financial freedom side and you're willing to collaborate to turn Bitcoin into a tool for the same people it was supposedly created to, you know, fight against, I don't respect you.
Yeah.
You suck. Yeah. That's how I feel about it.
That's why we've really been beating the drum. Like, don't buy the ETF. The ETF is the whole BlackRock ETF. The fact that BlackRock was like calling Bitcoin like terrible, it was like anti-ESG, and then you have this complete about face. Like, oh, we love Bitcoin. We're going to get the largest ETF.
I think they can use it to benefit them as things move forward. Yeah. And there's a fight to be had for the control of Bitcoin. For sure. Do you want the Larry Finks to win? I don't. you know, I think it's pretty clear, at least, you know, people that believe in like financial freedom, like what side to choose. And there's a lot of work to be done there. Because if the people that care about financial freedom just sit back and don't do anything to keep Bitcoin as a, you know, as potentially helping that, it will be lost and it will be hollowed out and turned into a zombie that serves the same powers that be that are fucking everything up. Let's not do that, guys.
Completely agree.
Again, anyway, I've got to go because I've got a hungry baby who's upset. So
well, you go feed your baby.
Probably have another minute or two. Yeah.
Well, thank you for coming back on the show. There's a lot of stuff popping off. I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll talk sooner rather than later, because things are, I don't think, going to decelerate from here. But no, I'm happy to see you. I'm happy to see you back in the saddle. I know it was a tough winter for you, and I was thinking about you a lot in the last few months. And
well, thanks, Marty. Yeah, I mean, it's nice to be back and talking about stuff and not just, you know, being a mom 24/7. But it is my first and most important job. So, yes. You know, got to do what you got to do.
Yes.
Yeah. So
kids always come first.
And hopefully we'll be back to work kind of normally with a better internet connection next month. I'd like that very much. But it's kind of slow going because my son, since we got out, has been in and out of the hospital. We have to go back on Sunday for a few days. Hopefully that'll be the last of it for a while and I can kind of work again. That'd be nice.
Well, I'll be praying for you guys and thank you. Keep crushing it. Keep sticking the needle in the eyes of these despots who want to control us.
What I live for, I guess. That and the people I care about, you know.
Yeah. Well, we're going to win. A lot of black pills, a lot of history, but there are some white pills too.
Well, I guess it's a black pill in the sense if you feel like you have like no agency over events, and I don't really think that's true.
No.
I think the people that invest in preparing and divesting and taking responsibility for themselves will be pretty well off when things, hit the fan, so to speak. I mean, it's going to be crazy, but you just got to be in the right mindset for it. And you got to be practical about how to prepare.
Yeah. And also, if you're out there, because I know a lot of you are out there, you email me. There's a lot of people in prominent positions who believe the same things we do, but feel that they can't speak up. They self-censor. Speak up. That's what we need more of, too.
Well, people just need to stop being afraid about it. Like, the stakes are very high. And I mean, if you're like afraid about it all the time, to paraphrase Dune, you know, fear is the mind killer. It's very true. And from people that have survived economic collapse, like in Argentina, for example, I live in South America, so I know people from Argentina that had to live through that. They all say your state of mental preparedness is like the most important, because if you're panicking and freaking out and you don't think clearly, you make bad decisions.
Yeah. Mentally prepare. We'll end it there. Whitney, It's always a pleasure.
Likewise, Marty. Thanks.